Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Yining. I'm a PhD candidate at the Department of Government at Harvard University, where I'm a political theorist working on a dissertation on postcolonialism and decolonization in Southeast Asia. Today, I'm so excited to be talking with Dr. Joseph McKay of the Australian National University about his new book, The Counterinsurgent Imagination, A New Intellectual History.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. McKay is a fellow in the Department of International Relations at the Australian National University. He holds a PhD from the University of Toronto, and he works on historical international hierarchies, international security, and the history of international thought. So, Dr. McKay, I thought we'd just start by asking you to tell us a little bit about where this book came from and how you came to the topic.
Sure. Well, the book originated as a political science international relations dissertation. I was a kind of a critical humanities undergraduate way back when, so I had a kind of a prior orientation towards, I guess, broadly questions of intellectual history. And for reasons, wound up in the social sciences for my PhD. It was looking for a kind of a fairly conventional project on the questions of kind of political violence, broadly understood, origins of political order, sort of big basic things like that, to which international relations I hoped could speak. And the literal immediate source of the project was the project kind of started where the book starts. I was rooting around in the source material looking for a puzzle, as we do, and was looking at some of the applied counterinsurgency material, thinking it might have something to say about what was not well understood about these things. And instead, what reading particularly this 2006 David Petraeus article on what he claims he had learned in Iraq about counterinsurgency, found that that the text was itself just kind of facially obviously puzzling. The instructional texts themselves are just unusual documents, short ones, long ones, old ones, new ones. They don't tell you how to do what they say they are telling you how to do straightforwardly. They come with this large extra ideological load of various kinds, and that load varies a lot over time. So the question was just how to make sense of that variation over the historical longer haul. So I took that to what was then my doctoral committee, and they said, well, so I did something a little bit more conventional for the PhD, and then in the revision came back, and the book became what it is, which is this kind of long-run intellectual historical reconstruction of what I call counter-revolutionary war.
That's fascinating. And the main theoretical argument is you know, beautifully and succinctly encapsulated in these three terms. You describe the counterinsurgent imagination as conservative, high modern, and utopian in nature. Could you tell us about this main theoretical claim?
Sure. So the kind of the starting argument or premise of the book is really just the sort of definitional apparatus, which is that politically speaking, counterinsurgency or counter-revolutionary war has these three qualities. The first is that it is conservative, or at least becomes conservative. And this is very nearly a definitional matter, right? It's conservative in the sense of being opposed to change, being prone to conserving or reacting against change over the longer haul. It's a form of counter-revolutionary project. Now, what gets conserved changes over time, but that's the basic first premise. The second I get from James C. Scott, the political anthropologist who describes what he calls a condition of high modernism in certain sorts of political or state-making projects in particularly the 20th century, by which he means a kind of a way of viewing and acting in the world and seeing the world, particularly visualizing the world, which is grounded in a kind of a normalization and in formalization and visualization of the world as linear, straight, systematic, alighting local detail, variation, mess generally. This is his fairly famous argument in Seeing Like a State. And so my claim is that counterinsurgents do that. They see the world on those terms. And finally, I argue that it's utopian. And I use that word mostly to capture a sense of scale. Counterinsurgency as something that is perhaps done locally, but imagines projects of making the world a certain sort of thing, making the world a certain sort of thing in terms of how it's structured politically. So it's conservative, a kind of conservative utopia, and its way of proceeding to a conservative utopia is high modern in the sense of avoiding any kind of variance, any kind of flexibility, any kind of local mess. So the argument is that the counterinsurgency acquires that quality around when the word counterinsurgency is coined. It first crops up in America about 1961 or two or so, around American defense intellectuals, particularly at the RAND Corporation. And what the book tries to do is reconstruct that moment and the way those ideas persist from there, but then also running back from there, how ideas about small wars or counter-revolution or what have you vary over the last several centuries running up to that consolidating moment.
So let's talk about the historical story that you just referred to, right? You say that it kind of becomes that conservative, high modern utopian project. Although actually, now that I say that, is there like a sort of irony there in the characterization? You know, the irony that I see reading the book is that they're conservative in the sense that they're trying to prevent a radical overturning of the existing order, but in the course of trying to prevent that radical overturning, they actually create or try to create the world that they think they already inhabit, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So there are, in a sense, there are two ironies running in parallel here. On the one hand, the worlds they're trying to recreate are, in a sense, fictions. They're idealizations. They are the things that American counterinsurgents are doing in Southeast Asia in the 1960s don't involve converting those countries into some version of the actually existing United States of America. They involve trying to enact some set of American liberal centrist anti-communist political ideals. Think of somebody like Ed Lansdale in Vietnam and the Philippines and elsewhere, trying to enact a kind of idealized vision of American of an American-led political order. So on the one hand, the thing they're reconstructing isn't always particularly real, present or recent past. On the other hand, the target moves because over the longer historical haul, counterinsurgents often lose, counter-revolutionaries often lose, modern political change, whether we want to call it progressive or not, the change happens, right? So the present or recent past that conservatives are often trying to conserve or recreate is itself a moving target over time. So if you look at this in early modern Europe, it's some sort of absolutist monarchy or something like that, depending on the context. Context of the French Revolution, it's about suppressing liberal nationalist revolutionary ideas in Western and Central Europe. You look at the European colonial empires, it's about the maintenance of colonial rule in at that point, chiefly in Africa and Asia. So the target of what's being conserved moves as well. So that formulation, that tripartite formulation, is a form, not a content, if you like, because the content that's being fed into it, to the extent that it, versions of it predate that 1960 or so threshold, those contents shift over time, sometimes quite dramatically. And then bits of that old stuff will tend to wind up baked in later on, often kind of submerged, forgotten. It's often there without the rearticulators of it quite knowing what they're carrying over.
I like that, that kind of submerging and forgetting. I want to get to that for sure later when we talk about the manuals as genre. But let's start with the, let's go on with the intellectual history that really forms the meat of the book in a way and is the substance of chapter one. So could you tell us about that long run history that you reconstruct and bring us up to speed, basically?
Yeah. So there is this sort of kind of putatively long chapter after the introduction that synoptically reconstructs the history over the long haul. So being as quick as I can, the earliest recognized counterinsurgent or counter-revolutionary manual broadly is an instructional text on colonial warfare from the Spanish in Central and South America, Chapin Vargas Machuca, dated 1599. And it recirculates a bit. We see it recur over time a little bit, but it's a surprisingly odd text. And the next eruption of these things happens not in colonial context so much as in Europe itself, particularly Central and Eastern Europe, where a bunch of ideas are about what are known chiefly in French and German as small wars. Begin to enter the European military mainstream from what are seen to be kind of marginalized peoples in the region, from rural settings and what have you. So militarized peoples like Cossacks or others in Central and particularly Balkan Europe become ideas that European military practitioners are interested in. They can kind of appropriate these people as separate sorts of military units that will operate as so-called light infantry or what have you. And eventually these things get formalized in a series of instructional texts around the roughly the late 18th century. So we have this class of things called small wars that are not particularly conservative. They're certainly not utopian in any set of ways, and they're not yet high modern. So how do you get from there to where we are now? Well, part of this runs through the kind of translation of the concept of small wars into colonial contexts. So we get late 19th century instructional texts by people like Charles Edward Caldwell, who's one of the case studies in the book. And a variety of rough French equivalents who write instructional texts essentially on the production and maintenance of European colonialism. And they are much more explicitly ideological. They have the ideological project of the empires they represent. Caldwell, at least, is quite conservative. He's quite explicitly opposed to kind of liberal or progressive or reformist conceptions of empire. He's explicitly a kind of a reactionary about those imperial ideas. He's writing right around the end of the 19th century. So we begin to see a kind of nascent conservatism there. And eventually, over the run of the 20th century, we begin to see what might be thought of as high modern ideas creeping in as well, as counterinsurgency becomes attached to the kind of the big ideological projects of the 20th century, but also to new revolutionary projects, because they're responding to new things. So by the time these guys are responding to Maoist revolutionary war in East and Southeast Asia, they're reacting to a kind of a big systematic high modernist Marxist project of revolutionary change, and they begin to internalize ideas from their opponents along the way.
Which means that's the second irony in the theoretical argument, right? This is the, I think I'm quoting or misquoting Sujit Sivasundaram in his book here, but he says that imperial counter-revolutionary agency folds in the revolutionary agency of the colonial insurrection. I was reminded of that in your argument.
That sounds like something he'd say, yes. that is roughly the form of argument here, that the practice of opposing someone will eventually lead you to take seriously their ideas. And in the colonial context, this means that they end up internalizing a bunch of ideas from the counterinsurgents or the imperial counter-revolutionaries wind up internalizing a bunch of ideas from the political projects they're opposing, which are themselves these big reconstructive enterprises of revolutionary change.
And do they do that? Do they do that because it's a central way in which they're able to counter the revolution, or do they do that for kind of some other reasons?
I think they often don't know they're doing it. A huge amount of this is, I think, a fairly subconscious or not wholly reasoned out set of things that these folks are doing. They do have to deal with their opponents intellectually and otherwise in order to at least attempt to do what they think they're doing. But in so doing, they will tend to wind up appropriating a bunch of ideas to which they thought they were opposed. So the kind of ideal case of this for me is David Kalula, the French North African counterinsurgent theorist, who's the third case in the book. So Kalula spends a good bit of time in East Asia in various guises as a military attaché, first in Republican China and then later in Hong Kong. And ends up seeing a lot, directly and indirectly, of Maoist Revolutionary War, first in China and then elsewhere in the region, and internalizes a bunch of the conceptual apparatus of what revolution is from that. Meantime, we think we know from his reading habits and certainly from his formal training that he actually didn't know a whole lot about traditional prior conceptions of European colonial warfare. So he's building this whole thing up himself from these specific contextual cues. So he doesn't have a lot other than his enemies to draw on. So he winds up picking up this Maoist story where he says essentially we'll defeat the revolutionaries by running the Maoist program stepwise in reverse. He says this fairly explicitly. Winds up picking that up and taking it to the Algerian Revolutionary War, which was only notionally socialist, certainly not Maoist, and had limited connections to the quite limited when he was there connections to the broader communist world, and says, "Well, we'll do it here." And then, of course, it doesn't quite fit, and so he says, "Well, we'll make some exceptions." But the kind of paradigmatic core of his program winds up still being stuff that he's borrowed from his opponents, rather than anything he'd learned in any particularly practical way or from past practice.
And the 1960s seems to me to be a particular hinge in this intellectual historical as well as theoretical story that you tell, insofar as it's by the 1960s in the, not the wave, but in the kind of cluster of counterinsurgent wars against decolonization in the global Cold War that we really see the emergence or the full emergence in a way of the kinds of counterinsurgent war that you describe. So can you tell us a little bit more about the 1960s then as a hinge in this story?
Yeah, so that long chapter I was talking about does start in about 1962. There's this kind of catalytic moment where the Rand Corporation gets a bunch of people together and, you know, in a hotel conference facility in Washington. Rand people, uniformed people, a number of people who weren't American. French Kalula was there, British Frank Kitson was there. Napoleon Valeriano, a Filipino-American officer who'd served against the Japanese and then against the communists with the Americans and eventually became a U.S. citizen. These folks had served all over the place, just about literally, and brought in this kind of catalytic account of counterinsurgency, which they would then repackaged to become the kind of the standard American form of counterinsurgency, which is what we now talk about today when we use counterinsurgency or abbreviate it as COIN or what have you, hearts and minds, all population control, all of that stuff. So the kind of catalytic moment out of which that emerges is that moment in the early 1960s, which is not coincidentally around when the word counterinsurgency is coined. Before that, we're talking about a variety of kind of other cognate concepts. So all of that happens in not quite the context of Vietnam yet. That's still getting going. But American support for the residual European colonial empires, to the extent the U.S. was supporting them, the perceived project of opposing the rolling out of communism here and there, the Cuban Revolution that just happened, and so on and so forth. So it was a kind of a Cold War liberal anti-communist project in that original form. And we get that more or less down to today and with some twists and turns along the way. But getting to that moment requires all of this odd prior stuff. One of the things that's interesting about these people in that 1962 moment at Rand is that they're not terribly backward looking. They don't cite, as far as I can work out, they didn't cite any historical events from before 1945. They don't cite prior manuals. All of that stuff is taken to be passed as a kind of prologue. They think they're not interested in any of that. So when we go back and we find that they're recycling ideas that date from, say, the French around 1900 in Southeast Asia or North Africa, that date from the Marine Corps Small Wars Manual, U.S. 1940, which contains a lot of material recycled from the American occupation of the Philippines. When we find that stuff creeping back in, it's all stuff that they're either pretending isn't there, or because we have a kind of transcript of the conference that they maybe don't even think they're recycling. And yet those ideas resurface along the way. So it's a hinge point, but it's not the hinge point that they think it is. They think they're starting fresh, and in practice they're rethinking ideas that that had been kicking around in various forms along the way. They're getting rid of some things. Some people don't get invited to the conference. Galula was there, but he was actually kind of marginal in French imperial military life at the time. He wasn't a central figure. Roger Chanquier, the French theorist, who was probably more visible to French military elites at the time. Much more openly does things like endorse torture. Well, that didn't fit the American liberal story the way they wanted to tell it. It didn't fit the politics the way they wanted to elaborate them. So I don't know the specifics, but I do know he wasn't present. And he would have been the obvious first person to invite from France. So we get some shaving off of ideas as well, probably fairly explicitly. But the carrying through of ideas isn't supposed to be part of the story, and yet it seems to be. Whether they knew or acknowledged it or not.
So then, what is it exactly about the 1960s? In some ways, the answer is pretty obvious. It's decolonization and the global Cold War. But certainly, there's also some underlying threats here about the kind of story that Niles Gilman tells in Mandarins of the Future about Cold War social science. There's a story here about the rise of America as a hegemonic power in international relations. There's some sort of story here about the rise of international institutions as a coordinating actor in international politics. Are all those things coming together in the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The Gilman book does crop up here in some ways. And you're right, the obvious answer, I think I at some point I call it the obvious answer, is Americans got this particular counterinsurgency because it's the one they ordered, it's the one they wanted, and they were paying the bills. And literally paying the bills. The Pentagon budget for research on this grew something like eightfold over a handful of years in this period. It was very sudden. There were essentially no official manuals, or almost none in 1945. There's one army, one in the mid-50s, written by a sort of an oddball who was drawing on a variety of random texts he found. By the mid-60s, there were dozens of texts like this. So there's this massive additional injection of kind of intellectual effort. And it's about an American decision to do this and to take it seriously. And some of that is Vietnam specifically. Some of it's the global Cold War. Some of it's America's complicated relationship with European decolonization. And the fact that they were inevitably borrowing ideas from that context by bringing in these European sources. Some of it is the ideological project of American liberal Cold War anti-communism, which is very much a project of opposing opposing decolonization that wasn't the kind that America decided it happened to want, right? So you ended up with a lot of pro-colonial, if you like, activity by the United States colonial, in the sort of the narrow European sense, I mean, simply because the U.S. was going along with things that appeared to be anti-communist. And of course, the Europeans were very happy to sell Americans on these things on that basis, or at least to try to. And it involves the rise of American social science during this period, specifically modernization theory, which was a kind of a liberal centrist project in most respects. Walt Whitman Rostow was all over this in all sorts of ways, as a person with policy attachments, as one of the core modernization theory intellectuals, and some of the other guys to lesser degrees. Samuel Huntington comes up here from time to time, although he was not one of those guys specifically. He was a bit more to the right. So the folks who were forming the core of American of American kind of progressive social science, gradualist social science at the time, were very much involved in this. And that was new. There hadn't really been social science outside of things like kind of British imperial anthropology. There hadn't been this kind of involvement from things like political scientists, at least before. So we get this kind of high modernist big structural story about historical progress and change in this kind of stepwise way. The kind of policy-facing book that Rostow writes is literally subtitled "A Non-Communist Manifesto." They weren't being subtle about it, like not even a little bit. And they wind up, in his case, endorsing quite dramatic levels of violence in defense of that.
So then, in your mind, and in the book also, what is the central purpose then? What do we gain from reconstructing this very long-run history from European small wars running up to the 1960s? Is it about, as you say, those intellectual cues and the kind of sometimes unselfconscious imbibing of ideas from earlier kinds of wars, and we need to kind of see that sedimentation almost, and when we try to understand present counterinsurgency?
Yeah, it shows us a few things. It shows us that it shows us that these people were not always doing and thinking what they thought they were. It shows us that they were participants in the sedimentation of ideas over time, and they in turn get themselves sedimented and picked up by later people later on, often in at least somewhat unexpected ways. It shows us that the sedimented material on which they were drawing was often both unattractive and ineffectual, because as I say, these folks did tend to lose in the long run. The Europeans really did lose their empires. The project of enforcing European colonial rule did, at least in its formal forms, completely fall apart. So drawing on lessons learned from doing that, replicating those past practices would presumably, even if you wanted to defend these practices, not be the way you'd want to go about it. And of course, then it's also tied up with a great deal of really ugly colonial violence along the way as well. So it's also the attachment to that past practice to which these folks will tend to claim limited debts. Knowingly or otherwise, Galula is at least trying not to attach himself back to these sorts of ideas. The earlier counterinsurgents like Caldwell really didn't know anything about the earliest case in the book is from the American Revolution. He had no idea about any of that, never set foot in America. And yet ideas about small wars really do date to that European early modern, eventually kind of period of revolutions set of practices. So recovering the forgetting shows us both that they were forgetting, that their ideas have internal inconsistencies that we can't tell if we take them at face value, and shows us that they are attached to past practices that are both really, really nasty and also in the long run ineffectual. So if there's a knock-on effect toward future practice, it would have to do with recognizing that our intellectual debts in these areas are not always nice and not always going to do us any favors.
Let's zoom in then on this question of race and colonialism and empire. This is kind of, again, like a different kind of hinge in the book in the sense that the small wars, as you say earlier, really become this particular kind of counterinsurgent war through the colonial project, right? So help us understand what role race plays in the story and what changing role it plays in the story if it changes. You talk about Victorian racism coming together with a certain kinds of colonial practices during this time. And I imagine that, you know, very much changes over time. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Race is central to the story, and it's always there, and it's always taking on new forms, if you like. So if we go back to those early modern European contexts, there is a sort of a nascent set of ideas about race there. The peoples from whom these ideas are being drawn about small warfare are marginalized peoples who were viewed as in various ways different to Europe's margins. So we think about what I understand. We now think of sort of the long history of ideas about race dating to things like late medieval Europe. This is about European encounters with Slavic peoples, for example, with non-white peoples surrounding Europe and so on. So those sorts of ideas, European attitudes toward the Ottoman Empire, for example, would have been rattling around in these ideas from the beginning, although people would not have used the word race. We move on from there to that kind of high colonial period. And somebody like Caldwell routinely talks about race. The word appears on dozens of pages in his book. He uses it in a putatively empirical way to talk about specific peoples. It's explicitly hierarchical, and it's very much about justifying specific forms of violence against specific sorts of people. So by the time we hit that kind of high watermark of explicit and open racial discourse, it's very, very clear that this sort of idea is doing central work in these texts. Then it begins to drop away in various respects. Part of that is a kind of a 30-year hiatus in counterinsurgency talk during the two world wars, when Europeans are concerned with other things militarily. But when these ideas recur after 1945, and especially after 1960, people are trying not to talk in those ways anymore. The ideas are still affecting them in various ways, but it ceases to be a thing that you say quite so openly. So somebody like David Galula will come to America in the early 60s, and the civil rights movement is getting going. And we can safely assume he could see that he wasn't supposed to talk this way, even if he might have been thinking those things. So what he writes in English for his American audience doesn't talk about race all that explicitly at all. But we see all of these sorts of recurring tropes about colonized peoples and about kind of dividing and conquering different sorts of peoples described in essentialized ways and so on. Racial categories are plainly operating in his thinking. He's just not using the word. And it kind of gets submerged further from there as we get to, for example, the current American counterinsurgents, or at least those of the very recent past, the 2006 Field Manual 324, the Petraeus et al. Document with which my book kind of opens in a sense. They say they don't want to be racist, and they're kind of liberal centrist American types. They probably think they don't want to be racist, and yet they're still drawing on all of these old ideas, sometimes pretty explicitly. They cite Caldwell as a classic. They cite Galula repeatedly, and then sometimes quote him without attribution in other instances. So these ideas seem to be pretty deeply recurring in these spaces. They seem to want to get rid of them, and yet can't. And of course, the whole context of these wars is still overwhelmingly conflicts involving or against non-white peoples outside the North Atlantic. So the entire context remains bound up with racial categories pretty unavoidably. So this stuff is still there. Even when they try to get rid of it, they find they effectively can't. So that's that kind of persistent, intervening, long durée again, kind of getting in the way of rethinking things.
And that definitely sounds to me like it plays out that dynamic that you theorize as well about it, kind of folding in the ideas of the insurrections that they are trying to counter, the insurrections and revolutions they're trying to counter. I mean, you know, as you see, part of the anti-colonial claim is that race should no longer, you know, be function as that categorizing device, that it should no longer function as the division between those who hold power and those who don't. That kind of gets reiterated, like conservatively, radically, in a way, recast into the counterinsurgent, counter-revolutionary doctrine.
Exactly. So if you go looking for the word race in the 2006 manual, they use it almost exclusively to refuse it, almost exclusively to declare their own race blindness. And then it sort of crops up in a variety of other contexts to do with how other peoples in theaters of wars might feel about race as a category and so on. The manual states very explicitly that race is a sort of social fiction, that it doesn't exist. It doesn't really exist biologically or anything like that. Don't worry. But then they wind up finding themselves having to talk about it anyway, because these wars are still in some sense racially structured in a variety of ways that they kind of can't avoid even if they want to.
Which is also then, again, about that earlier logics getting built in and sedimented in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the method and the sources that you use, which I, as a political theorist who is very concerned with genre and text, find absolutely fascinating. So you use manuals as the central source of the book. And this is the way you structure the chapters, one manual for each of the four chapters that form the core body of the argument. And you call manuals idealized frameworks for military conduct. And this thinking about the manual as a genre and a kind of source really gets you to some very, very interesting questions about means and ends, about text and context, about practice and ideas. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Manuals are sort of a form of writing. And I'm using the word retrospectively, of course. They wouldn't have used it before, probably sometime in the 1960s for this stuff, or the 50s, maybe a little earlier. Certainly not before the 20th century. Not so much, at least. They're one of these sort of sorts of texts that once you look for them, they're kind of everywhere. A lot of what we think of as our kind of core, the dead white dudes forming the old canon of political theory, huge amounts of that stuff is actually intended instructionally. It's the mirrors for princes genre. It's the kind of pedagogical project of Hobbes's Leviathan. If the Communist Manifesto was not an instructional text, I don't know what it is. So the instructional purpose of lots of kinds of theoretical writing is kind of right there before us once we look for it. And those sorts of, especially more applied texts, have played a sort of an interesting role in some of the internal historical debates in international relations about the origins of ideas like sovereignty and so on. So these things are there if you're looking for them. When we look for these more sorts of practical texts, it does sometimes impose certain sorts of methodological constraints or requirements on us. Most of these folks will not state their political priors up front, because that's not what you do when you're looking to instruct people on how to conduct a particular applied kind of warfare. Sometimes they even explicitly refuse them. Caldwell very clearly says that he's a theoretical person, or a sort of anti-theoretical person. He has no interest in theoretical priors. Everything should be about doing stuff in applied ways. And he winds up being that person that John Maynard Keynes talks about. You know, Keynes, who says somewhere that everyone has a theory. The person who says he has no theory is just beholden to some dead economist. Well, Caldwell, some dead economist is the British Empire. Galula is more theoretically facing. He knows he's drawing on, for example, revolutionary theorists like Mao, but is still bound up with this idea of teaching us practice, not theory, because he wants to speak to an applied military audience. And we see versions of this sort of tension right through to the 2006 manual, where the underlying theoretical apparatus isn't really dealing with warfare at all. It's about administration. It's about bureaucracy. It's about it's drawn from organizational studies largely, and from management science and things like this. So we have all of these underlying priors, and because they're not usually all that explicitly stated, sometimes they are, which is interesting, but because they're not explicitly stated, we have to reconstruct them or go looking for them in autobiographical writings. If you weren't already convinced that somebody like Caldwell had this deep set of racial structuring ideas about the world, his memoirs will disabuse you of that, I promise. If you're confused about the ideological priors of someone like Johann Evold, the Hessian mercenary who's the subject of the first case, based on his 8 years or so in America, we can read his diaries, which tell us a lot about how he sees the world. Some of which seems to be just confused, and he's not, because he really isn't a very theoretical person, he's a little bit all over the map, but we can reconstruct his basic set of ideas about the world by looking at things like that. So manuals require us to do certain sorts of things in terms of reconstructing the ideas rather than just looking for them on the page. Hopefully we're doing some of that in close reading anyway, but you really have to do it here. Once we do that, they tell us something about the nexus of theory and practice and how it operates historically over time. So how ideas about practice draw on theory, how theory winds up drawing on past practice or trying to, and so on. And because manuals operate at that kind of doctrinal nexus of thinking about what's worked in practice in the past versus how we conceptualize the world, because they're at that nexus. they're forced to do that translating work back and forth between abstractions and practices, between past and present and so on. And we don't always see them explicitly doing that or claiming to do that, but they're tacking back and forth across those dyads much or most of the time because they have to.
And do you find it necessary then to treat these authors, and in the case of, I think, the fourth manual, this multiple set, this cacophony of authors. I love that word. Always trips me up. Do you find it necessary then to treat them with a special methodological care, because they're not the, in a way, not the classic kind of authors that intellectual historians and in a way political theorists are used to dealing with? How did you read them?
I mean, ultimately, I'm not a trained historian, so my best answer in some sense is carefully. But I tried to think contextually. The theoretical sources that I to which I tie myself are chiefly kind of Skinnerian, Cambridge School sorts of folks and attached stuff. And I think those folks would recognize an applied character in the sorts of texts they study. So it should be a good fit in that sense. I read with an assumption that there are going to be some unspoken things that need to be teased out, at least if I want to make the kind of argument or engage in the kind of analysis that I want to make. And I read with an eye to connections to prior texts and concurrent other texts in the field. And because all areas of textual work widen out over time, they expand in scope and scale. The number of these texts is, circa 1800, there were probably less than a dozen of them we'd regard as particularly classical and well-preserved and important that we'd look back to. And they're mostly French and German early moderns. By 1960, there are dozens upon dozens of these things in multiple languages, across multiple settings, trying to do multiple things, and just working out whether or not there are connections and how many of those connections might be becomes more complicated. So looking for discursive points of overlap, looking for references shared, literal referencing sometimes in the form of citation, but I mean, more often just shared anecdotes, shared rhetorical devices, stuff like this. So the French and the British circa 1900 are actually saying very different things about how to conduct colonial warfare. Caldwell is this sort of kind of violent reactionary, whatever it is that he is. The French, like Hubert Lyautey, are already engaging in this sort of, he uses the word oil spot, this sort of more nascently high modern, more a sort of approach that involves a more targeted kind of violence and a kind of a generation of political order or an attempt to, it has economic aspects. It looks much more like the early to mid 20th century conception of colonialism that we associate with the economic devices of these things, with targeted administrative practices and so on, none of which interests Caldwell at all. So we see that there's a divergence going on there in a period where we think of these things as pretty tightly overlapping. So it shows us that these folks are maybe not reading one another, for one thing, although they were in translation back and forth, and shows us that there's more than one track in which the story is running at any given time.
This whole conversation has taken place under the specter of present counterinsurgent wars, post-9/11 counterinsurgent wars. And this is also the kind of contemporary global context that you very poignantly end the book with in the conclusion. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you think this theoretical and intellectual history argument might reinform, recast, or illuminate our understanding of present warfare, present counterinsurgent warfare?
Sure. The present long moment of this stuff kind of begins and ends in Afghanistan, right? Begins at the end of 2001 and ends about a year and a half ago now, when the war was not winding down so much as suddenly ending, with the Taliban occupation of Kabul as the Americans were preparing to withdraw. So that, along with Iraq, was what motivated the production of the 2006 manual. What does all of this historical material tell us about that present? Well, it tells us that it reminds us, this should be obvious, but we seem to need it, that these things have tended to fail in the past, and they have failed for reasons to do with doctrinal choices about the kinds of wars people have tried to fight. I say try, what's happened on the ground is often much messier and more violent, and it doesn't reliably reflect the manuals. The manuals are not actual records of reliable practice. But even imagining that they're trying to do these things, the attempts to do these things in the past have tended not to go very well. So it reminds us that we can, we should at a minimum approach these things with a fair degree of humility, even if we imagine we want to try to do them. I would hope we wouldn't, but it reminds us that that our ideas are not very new for the most part. We translate them, we reframe them, we attach them to new trappings of various sorts, like American military bureaucracy in its elaborate current form. But we don't tend to change all that much about what hasn't worked in the past. When we change our minds about things, it tends to be for political, circumstantial, ideological reasons, rather than any kind of actual efficient adaptation to the applied problem of winning these wars. So again, imagining even that you wanted to fight these things, we tend to get it wrong. Perhaps we should avoid doing so. And of course, there are all sorts of perfectly good political reasons not to try in the first place. But imagining we're not going to catch people on that argument, at least we can show them that it's that it has tended to go badly, in theory.
I can't even begin to imagine what you do after working on a topic like this, but can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now?
I'm that guy that took too long to revise a dissertation that took too long to write. That anecdote with which the book and the project started, I think I first read that article about 2010, so that gives you a sense of the how much too long this has taken. Defended the dissertation in 2015. The next thing I think will focus a little bit more explicitly on, in a sense, it'll be a political theory or an international political theory project. And I'm interested in what I'm calling reactionary international thought. So I'm interested in accounts of world ordering or of world politics or what, you know, since the post-war period, we call international relations theory, that are explicitly right-wing and explicitly not just conservative, but reactionary or nostalgic or backward-looking. And there's an interesting emerging literature on these sorts of ideas, especially in the post-war period. I think I'm interested in the longer haul, so I think it'll be a similarly structured story looking at several cases. I want to start with Joseph de Maistre around the French Revolution, who had quite elaborate ideas about how European political order should be structured in response to French revolutionary transformation. I'm not sure what the full population of people will be, but I'd like to look at Samuel Huntington at the end as an example of this sort of reactionary thinking about world politics. So I think that's the next project. I'm just writing the grant now, but that's where it's
that's where it all begins with the grant, as we all know.
One's got to pay for it. So,
well, that sounds so incredibly important and so fascinating, and I cannot wait for it. But thank you so much for coming on the New Books Network to talk about this very wonderful and timely book with us. And have a good evening.
Thanks. It's been great. Take care.